On Friday, February 7th, 2014, author, media critic, and producer of alternative radio, David Barsamian, spoke at the Community Church of Boston. The topic was Capitalism and the Crisis in Democracy. Although a serious topic, David opened with a bit of levity, mocking mainstream media reporting tactics.
We interrupt this program from Boston, Massachusetts, to bring you this breaking news story from TBIC, the Truth in Broadcasting Corporation, from our world corporate headquarters in a secure underground location in Area 51 in Nevada. I'm Dick Veneer, your glib and banal anchor of Facade News, the 24/7 newscast dedicated to keeping you in the dark. We go straight to the surface of a story and we stay there. No one can beat our in shallow reporting. We're dedicated to the highest principles of journalism. We deceive, you believe. Ladies and gentlemen, an amazing story coming across our news desk at this very moment. According to WXXX, an obscure radio station in Somerville, they are reporting that Ben Bernanke, Hank Paulson, Alan Greenspan, Timothy Geithner, Larry Summers, Lloyd Blankfein, and other government officials and bankers have been arrested for financial crimes against the people and planet Earth. Also taken into custody were Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, Cokey Roberts, Diane Sawyer, and Wolf Blitzer for lying to the American people. They were all found in locked embrace in a bunker under Copley Square with trillions of dollars in cash and a stash of World Wrestling Federation DVDs and a massive collection of Pat Boone and Barry Manilow CDs and scores of used Papa John's pizza boxes. The arrests were made here by a heretofore unknown group calling itself WLF, the Watertown Liberation Front. Chuck, a so-called spokesperson for this so-called group, who refused to give his last name, said, "This action is long overdue. We're dedicated to nonviolence and did not use force. But we had to act. We could no longer wait for the Obama Justice Department to enforce the law. They must face justice," he said, his voice rising in indignation. The prisoners in foot shackles and handcuffs in orange jumpsuits and with black cloaks over their head were later reported to have defiantly shouted at their captors, "Do you know who we are? We are the masters of the universe. We rule the world." And then, inexplicably, each one of them burst into tears and said, "I want my mommy." If convicted, they will serve time in Guantanamo. You'll recall the infamous U.S. prison that was returned to Cuban sovereignty in 2014. It looks like curtains for the former masters of the universe. Their heads were bowed as they were led away by blue-helmeted peacekeepers of WLF, the Watertown Liberation Front, headed by Commander Linda, who would not give her last name. I'm Dick Veneer. You're still glib and banal anchor. Stay tuned to Facade News on the TIBC network for updates on this breaking news story. Remember, we deceive, you believe. You either watch our news or you will be watched. Now back to our regularly scheduled program at the Community Church in Boston. Hey, hey, NSA, who are you going to spy on in what way? Hey, hey, TSA, who are you going to pull over today? UAVs rain death from the skies. Pilotless drones will blow out your eyes. Look out, here comes the FBI. IEDs, RPGs, WMDs, NSC, CIA, DEA. There goes the USA. There goes the USA. There goes the USA. Well, I thought I'd start in a very serious and traditional manner. No doubt you're expecting a long diatribe, but I like to inject humor and levity, particularly when it's laced with some, you know, has some factual content. And I must say I learned that from Howard Zinn. I, for many years, at his feet, learning about using humor and keeping it, you know, keeping things sharp, but also keeping them light almost simultaneously. It seems like a contradiction, but you know what the great 20th century philosopher Muhammad Ali said: you have to float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. So a little bit of balance. I'd like to thank Linda and this wonderful institution that you have here in Boston, the Community Church. I know there's many illustrious speakers have preceded me here, so it's a particular honor. And this evening caps a week of my being in the Boston area, giving talks from such diverse communities as Worcester and Watertown. It's been good. Unfortunately, Boston has a real problem with radical radio. It doesn't allow it to be broadcast. I'm speaking of the two big NPR affiliates here, WBUR and WGBH, two of the richest and most powerful radio stations in the country, do not have a single, I would say, out-of-the-box radio program. They don't have Democracy Now!, they don't have Counterspin, they don't have Making Contact, they don't have alternative radio. And, you know, when I travel around the country, you know, go to places like Montana and rural Colorado and New Mexico, and when I say talk about public radio in the U.S., well, they all think Boston must have the most radical and progressive stations anywhere. I mean, Boston, this is, you know, Athens on the Charles. You know, this is where Chomsky lives. This is where, you know, there's so much intellectual activity. And it's the exact opposite. For example, I mean, you may have certain ideas, I'm sure, about, you know, Montana and places like that. Alternative radio is on the state networks in those states in prime time, not buried at, you know, Sunday nights at 2 a.m., but in prime time. So it's very curious that this area has been locked off and there's such a lack of diversity in some things considered, as I call NPR's afternoon news program and morning edition, which should be MOURNING, because you should go into morning, you should be dressed in black when you're listening to morning edition, because you're just getting a cascade of fabrications and mendacities and really not any cutting edge information. And so it's a very disturbing situation. And in my particular case with alternative radio, they can't say that, you know, as some stations say, oh, David, you know, we really admire your work, you respect what you're doing, but, you know, our budget's a little tight this year. We can't afford to air your program. Well, alternative radio happens to be free to all community and public radio stations. So it's not about the budget. It's about the politics. It's about the content. It's about radical information. Because, you know, as Jefferson supposedly said, who knows what these founding finaglers actually said? Everybody quotes them, including me. But supposedly he said that information is the currency of democracy. And if that currency is limited to one or two coins, then the people are not informed. And it's hard to make informed decisions if you only are exposed to a range of opinion and a kind of a plethora of perspectives from A to B. I'm saying, you know, you need to hear from A to Z. You need a wide variety. You think of it, think of this issue in terms of nutrition. Think of it in terms of food. You know, let's just say you had a simple diet of white bread and peanut butter. Now, you'll get full, but it's not terribly nutritious. Your body needs much more, and much of the corporate media in particular, and NPR now falls into that category because they are supported largely by corporations, as is PBS, the Petroleum Broadcasting Service. Their biggest contributors are often ExxonMobil and BP and, you know, other green eco companies that love to, you know, greenwash their environmental crimes. So I think it's really important for a democracy to have that information and access to information. And then, you know, you have to wonder, you know, why do people have such cockeyed ideas about themselves, their society, and the world in general, and know much more about, let's say, really important issues like the Kardashian sisters' latest hair, or how big their hips can get, or Lindsay Lohan's, you know, latest rehab assignment, or Britney Spears, Justin Bieber getting arrested, Miley Cyrus, Katy Perry, you know, all of these stars. And of course, we just had last week the Super Bowl, which is the most watched event, apparently, in the world. Over 111 million people turned into what was arguably an incredibly boring game as well. And then the talk turns to, oh, did you see that ad? And did you see what Coca-Cola did? And what happened to Reese Witherspoon? And what happened to SodaStream? That ad didn't quite get on the air because of complaints. So we have a real crisis of democracy because of a crisis in the media. And so that's why the work of independent media people here, like Chuck and others, is so important. This gentleman here, there are a videographer here. It's so important to develop our own microphones, our own cameras, because if we're going to wait for them, we're going to wait forever. They're never going to show up because they're too invested in the system. They are part of the problem. And in terms of, you know, activism, you know, I like what Margaret Mead said decades ago, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. And we've seen that over and over again, where small groups of people get together and go up against power. Right now, for different reasons, you know, from Bangkok to Kiev, people are in the street. From Istanbul to Dhaka, people are in the street. They are revolting against the status quo. They want something different. They're fed up with neoliberalism. They're fed up with benefits being slashed and burned. They're fed up with services being reduced, safety nets being shredded. There's a lot of ferment right now. I mean, I don't recall a time in recent world history, except perhaps 67, 68, 69, when there were so many people out protesting, demonstrating, complaining about how societies are organized. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about democracy and reform and revolution, but I asked the question, last tango for democracy? From oligarchy to plutocracy to dollarocracy. And we live in a dollarocracy. That's a title of a Nichols and McChesney book. A system, a political system that's awash in corporate cash. I mean, the spigots are just, they're not even open. They don't exist. The money is just gushing into the campaign coffers of these different candidates. So as Ralph Nader suggested years ago, it would really be a service to the American people if their so-called representatives in Washington or the State House here wore numbers on their back corresponding to the corporation that gives them the most money. So if you say, let's say, number 7, oh, you understand that's IBM's representative. Or number 14, that's the representative of Chevron. Or 26 is, you know, this is Intel or Microsoft or Google or whatever. I think that would be a great service. A nation of sheep will beget a government of wolves. Well, that's Edward R. Murrow, by the way, who said that many years ago. I mean, he died in the mid-60s. But we see that with this vast surveillance state that has not mystically sprung up. This isn't any like magical thing that happened. It was systematic, it was intentional, and the events of September 11th were used as a pretext to expand and to consolidate government state power, state spying power in particular. I mean, the world of Orwell, as it's sometimes described, is really not at all accurate. I mean, Orwell would not recognize the level of surveillance that exists today. I mean, he was, you know, just in a very kind of a primitive state with a few TV sets monitoring people's activities. The current theatrics and posturing in Washington are a sideshow to the main event. And what's that main event? That is the ongoing evisceration and hollowing out of democracy. Democracy, a Greek word, demos, the people, krasi, a system of rule by the people. It's a system, it's an oligarchy, it's a plutocracy, it is a dollarocracy. The political system in which the capitalist economy effectively functions for the few is called democracy. It might be likened to a Sotheby's auction with the most lucrative objects, that is, seats in the Senate or the State House or in the House of Representatives, going to the highest bidder. It's no accident. Madison said more than two centuries ago, the aim of government is to protect the opulent minority against the majority. The aim of government is to protect the opulent minority against the majority. Is that not what the Occupy slogan embodied in the 1% versus the 99%? Well, here you have one of the, you know, founders of the Republic articulating it in not ambiguous terms, you know, very, very clear. This is what we are about, protecting the rich against the rabble, protecting the few against the many. So we have procedural democracy called elections, which have turned into multi-billion dollar campaign spending extravaganzas. It's a cash cow for the commercial corporate media, particularly TV. The Citizens United decision of June 2010, that is to say the Supreme Court's decision allowing corporate money to flood politics, further corrodes and eviscerates and corrupts what little democracy exists in the United States. In effect, it legalizes bribery. No, its defenders say, money is free speech. You, Jane and Joe Citizen, you're free to set up your own PAC and give money to your favorite politician, just like the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson. It's a level playing field, right? Yeah, sure. A tsunami of cash drowns out politics, making a farce of any notion of equality and fairness. And things may actually get worse. There's a case that the court is hearing right now that would also eliminate individual caps on giving to political candidates. A fundamental question that, which is never posed in this kind of bizarre equation, is what are the communication needs of a democratic society? You know, the role of the mediocre media and press corps is crucial in the manufacture of consent, to use Walter Lippmann's phrase in public opinion. A lot of people think that's Chomsky and Edward Herman's coinage, but it was actually the dean of American journalism, Walter Lippmann, in a book that came out in the early 1920s, right after he served literally on a propaganda commission that Woodrow Wilson created to bamboozle the American people into entering a World War I. There was tremendous anti-war opposition. Wilson had run in 1916 on a campaign of peace and non-involvement in Europe's wars. Within a year, American troops were fighting in Europe. And the way that happened was through this Committee on Public Information, also known as the Creel Commission, named after George Creel. It had Edward Bernays, one of the doyens of propaganda. He died a few years ago. He used to live in Cambridge. I think his daughter still lives around here, and Bernays, someone that the Nazis admired greatly for his and this whole movement's ability to manipulate and control the public mind. In fact, Bernays said the whole purpose of public relations and advertising is the regimenting of the public mind, the control of the public mind, in order to get you products that you don't need, in order to get you to buy products that you don't need. So as a kind of sidebar, Edward Bernays might be one of the major mass murderers of the 20th century. I choose my words very carefully. It was Edward Bernays that persuaded American women to smoke Chesterfields. There was a huge campaign in all the major magazines then, Look, Life, Saturday Evening Post, and others, full-page ads. Take a look at them, you know. Be cool, be independent. Don't listen to what your father or your older brother or your husband are telling you. You need to smoke. You need to assert yourself. How many hundreds of thousands of women have died because of cigarette smoking? How many other hundreds of thousands have died because of the high cholesterol breakfast that Edward Bernays sold to the American people? That was another one of his so-called great achievements. Bacon and eggs did not exist on the American breakfast table before the 1920s. It was a huge campaign, of course, supported by poultry and big agri, to push bacon and eggs. You needed to have a healthy breakfast. That's what it was called. And that too has, you know, I think the carnage that has resulted from these two events is simply appalling. You hardly hear anything about these kinds of things. So the media, and you know, I'll keep returning to the media because I think, well, reform or revolution, we don't need to reform the media, we need to replace it. You know, how can you reform Cokie Roberts or Wolf Blitzer? I mean, that's a serious question, it's not a rhetorical question. How can you reform, you know, Charlie Rose or Robert Siegel or, you know, any of the other, you know, network anchors, you know, and they're called anchors for good reason, as Howard Zinn used to say. They're anchored to the establishment. They've completely bought into the ideology, dominant hegemonic thinking, and just replicate all of the tropes of propaganda that the U.S. has a right to invade any country, the U.S. has a right to judge any country. No one has reciprocal rights, by the way. So if other countries, you know, have comments about U.S. policy like the death penalty and things like that, they are totally dismissed as irrelevant. But the U.S. proclaims these kinds of rights on the rest of the world. And so the media are a monochromatic one-note samba. That's if in musical terms. They are prostitutes, well-paid prostitutes, by the way. Those who, you know, sell themselves for access, for power, and for prestige. You know, when people walk into a room, I remember attending one of the national conventions in the 1980s, and, you know, Connie Chung walked into the room when she was a network anchor at the time. I mean, everybody just dropped everything and kind of rushed, the whole room rushed to this star, you know, with some kind of aura around her. It was very instructive to see that kind of blind adulation and adoration that the, you know, the anchors receive. Totally undeserved, in my view. They are best equipped to be stenographers rather than investigative journalists. Now, you know, I don't want to be like totally negative here, but why not, David? You're a double Gemini. That'll mean something to people who understand what that means. Otherwise, forget you just heard that. But a terrific bolt out of the blue now in this desert of non-reporting and journalism is Pierre Umidyar, the French-born Iranian-American who is putting his money where his mouth is. $250 million to create a new independent investigative journalism entity. Now, we don't know how this is going to develop exactly, whether it's going to be a magazine or a newspaper or an online presence or a radio program or a TV program or all of those things. But nevertheless, this is a major breakthrough, and he's already engaged three of the best independent journalists that we have in the country, Jeremy Scahill, Glenn Greenwald, and Laura Poitras. Two of them, Greenwald and Poitras, were instrumental in breaking the Edward Snowden story. So that's very, very exciting and positive news. And I must say, one of the reasons, because I know you're curious about this, you know, One of the reasons I started alternative radio almost 30 years ago was I was fed up with the media. Okay, great, fed up with the media. But I think it's important to have some kind of concrete response to something you don't like. You know, so if you don't like something, try and do something about it if you can. Or join with others who are working on this particular issue. So, I started alternative radio completely naked, I would say, and out of the blue. And I was guilty of every kind of technical blunder one could imagine in those days. I had, by the way, no training. This is for the young people in the audience primarily, but anyone, for anyone. I had no training. I'm entirely self-taught. So, you know, you sometimes pay the price for that. Like, I would be interviewing someone, and I never turned on the other person's mic. Or the reverse. The guest's mic was on, but my mic was not on. So people in Boulder were kind of very forgiving, you know, and they stopped me in the street, and they said, you know, we heard this program, and is this some kind of Zen exercise? You know, where we're supposed to imagine what the questions are because all they heard were the responses, or what the responses were because they only heard the questions. So I made all kinds of, you know, mistakes like that. But it's not, you know, rocket science. You can figure it out pretty fast, and I did. And so I've been, you know, doing this work now for 30 years. In fact, 30 years... not to the day, but I did my first interview with Chomsky by phone, and I couldn't hook the phone up to the tape recorder. So, and he was at home at Lexington, at his home in Lexington, so I said, I'm sorry, Noam. He was very gracious, and he said, when you figure it out, call me up. And I figured it out pretty fast. I made some quick calls, and someone told me, you know, you put this jack here and this one there, and that's how it, you know, kind of all started, and we just... have our, I think this is the eighth or ninth book I have with Chomsky called Power Systems. So how is alternative radio funded? Well, if you're not, you know, other than the $100,000 speaking fee I'm getting here tonight, you know, from the community church, that's in unmarked 20s in a brown paper bag that was left in the hallway. But beyond that, beyond those kinds of speaking fees, alternative radio generates income from the sale of programs. Now, that really hurts me in Boston because you can't hear the program. So you don't know I exist. You don't know the program is out there unless you go online or someone specifically tells you. Or you listen to WZBC, the Boston College station, which occasionally airs it randomly on Saturday. So it's very... drives one batty because I can't tell you, you know, tune in on this station at this time every week and you'll hear the program. So it doesn't happen that way here. And Boston is just, you know, a very, very difficult place. And I asked Chomsky about that once, why he thought that was the case. And he said the ideological stakes here are very high because of the concentration of power, because of the concentration of institutions, I'll call them, of lower learning. I think they, you know, higher learning is a little hyperbolic. And so that's why it's important that people are controlled here and not have access to progressive radical radio. Now, MBR, the MIT station where Chuck has been a volunteer for decades, decades. Has a very limited signal. I mean, they do great work. I hope you listen. But it doesn't reach very far. And this is true of all of the local college stations. They don't have big signals. So Tufts and BC and the others. So AR is really funded by listeners who buy CDs or books. And that's it. There's no secret behind it. There's no trust funds. And there's certainly no government or corporate money. Now, I think that news about what Pierre Omidyar is doing is very important. Another very striking positive development is the huge exponential growth in co-ops, all across the country. Gar Alperovitz has been really good about writing and documenting this. From, you know, I was in the Mission in San Francisco a few months ago, on walking on Valencia Street, and I looked up and there was this bakery. I think it was called Arizmendi's, and it said worker-owned co-op. So I went in and inquired, and it turns out there are six such bakeries and cafes in the San Francisco Bay Area. Land of Lakes Butter is a worker-controlled co-op. So is Ace Hardware. So is Nationwide Insurance. These are, I think, really very positive developments in breaking this kind of impregnability that capitalism likes to project. You know, we're the only show in town, like it or leave it, or move to North Korea. You know, end of conversation. Well, workers are organizing. They have democratic organizations. They have shares in the company. They share in decision making, which is very, very crucial. And many of them, like this bakery and cafe that I just described in the San Francisco Bay Area, take their inspiration from Mondragon. In fact, this bakery is named after the Catholic priest who started Mondragon in the Basque region in 1956. The Basque region was incredibly poor. It was just one of the most backward regions in all of Spain. And this Catholic priest started a cooperative there, agricultural at that time. And today, it is the seventh largest enterprise in Spain. They're just not raising growing avocados. They're making furniture, they're manufacturing industrial goods, and Mondragon Cooperative employs over 100,000 workers. So it is a success story of sorts. Is it perfect? Of course not. But it certainly provides an alternative to the existing system, which is, to use the term predatory capitalism is kind of an oxymoron, because capitalism has to be predatory. Not because they're evil people, not because they're, you know, nasty or mean or have bad hair days. This is what the economic system is about. It's about squeezing profits out of workers, extracting riches that Mother Nature has provided us so that they can increase their bottom line with total disregard for what are called externalities in their particular language. You know, well, the environmental impacts of, you know, draining the Charles River and building an ice skating rink there, that's somebody else's problem. I don't have to worry about that. I'm going to make money selling tickets to the ice skating rink that I want to build on the Charles. So you have, you know, a system that is encoded genetically to destroy the environment. I mean, that sounds a little, over the top. I don't think it's over the top. I think it's a very realistic observation and appraisal of what the economic system is doing to the earth. And we can see it in case after case. I mean, global warming, climate change is the most dramatic example, but there are many other species loss, habitat loss that is occurring on a absolutely unprecedented, again, a word that's often used, and I'll try and only use it once in this talk this evening, unprecedented, you know, level right now. Really, an understanding, there was a New Yorker cartoon that Michael Parenti brought to my attention, another radical voice that everybody should be familiar here with, one of the most insightful political analysts and media critics anywhere, Michael Parenti. Very close connection with alternative radio as well over the years, actually, since the very beginning. He brought to my attention, stockholders were some New York hotel. They were having a meeting, a corporation, the CEOs in front of them. The stockholders are clamoring, you know, where are our dividends? You know, we want to see more profits. You know, we need double-digit returns here. That's what you promised. That's why we gave you your job, your private jet, your mistress, your penthouse, your country home, second home in Aspen, all of those things. Where's the money? And he says in this cartoon, well, you know, in the long term, the fate of the earth is really sealed. We know what's coming down the pike. It'll be utter misery and chaos and war and deprivation and hunger. But right now, we can make money hand over fist. And here's what I'm going to do in the next quarter. And everybody jumps up and gives him a standing ovation. Did they hear what he just said? That the future is dark indeed and grim? Because any objective analysis can leave no doubt that that is indeed in the cards. And I have an interesting document here. Human beings and the natural world are on a collision course. Human activities inflict harsh and often irreversible damage on the environment and on critical resources. If not checked, many of our current practices put at serious risk the future that we wish for human society and the plant and animal kingdoms, and may so alter the living world that it will be unable to sustain life in the manner that we know. Fundamental changes are urgent if we are to avoid the collision our present course will bring about. Now, I don't want to play Jeopardy here, but does anyone recognize that paragraph I just read? 1992, world scientists warning to humanity. More than 1,670 scientists, including 104 Nobel laureates, issued this declaration that we are on a collision course. We are now, 22 years later, with virtually no sense of urgency, no prioritization of what needs to be done, and needs to be done very quickly. If the tar sands Keystone XL pipeline is approved, it'll just be one more nail in the coffin. But even if Obama doesn't sign it, Canada has promised it will export, it will dig out, extract those tar sands in northern Alberta, and by hook or crook, we'll get it to China. They're already building pipelines to both the Atlantic coast, I think in Nova Scotia, and they're trying to build pipelines through British Columbia as well. I mean, this is the filthiest of the filthy carbon-generating fuels, and Canada is sitting on a mountain of it in northern Alberta. And Alberta is a really interesting province in Canada. Any Canadians here? It's like, it's been described as Texas on steroids. It is the home base of this fundamentalist anti-science premier whose name is Stephen Harper. To say he's in the pocket of the oil and gas and fracking industry is a great understatement. I mean, he is the pocket. He's the whole pants, you know. He is, you know, actually driving this kind of extraction. This is the project that James Hansen has said will be the game changer. It will be game over for the planet. Now, I don't know enough about the science, but a lot of people have been talking in those terms, Bill McKibben, 350.org, and others, that this will be one of those major turning points where it would be very difficult to preserve and conserve what we have, which is the real definition of conservative. You know, it used to be a very honorable political term. You want to conserve what you have and build on it so that future generations can live and live a better life. This term has been totally inverted. It has become some kind of mad libertarian free-for-all to plunder and loot the earth of its resources. That's conservatism today. And kick people while they're down, as Barbara Ehrenreich calls it. You know, take away their food stamps. Bail out the banks and the bankers, but don't bail out people. Don't help people, you know. So banks are too big to fail, but people are not too big to fail. They simply fail. So there's, you know, I don't have to tell people here, huge unemployment problem in the country. People are underemployed. Millions of people have simply dropped out of the workforce. So they're not even counted as unemployed. I mean, there's serious problems, and I hesitate to even use the word capitalism to describe this. That's why I'm often saying the economic system or the system, because it's not really capitalism. It's a system that is heavily dependent on state intervention through the National Institutes of Health for development of vaccines and pharmaceuticals and other cures and breakthroughs in science, all paid for by we the people. And somehow, all of these great inventions and research that's carried out by very dedicated doctors and scientists, somehow it gets into the hands of Pfizer and Glaxo Smith and Klein and Eli Lilly and these other huge pharmaceutical companies. How does that happen? At what point do public inventions get turned over to private corporations? Like, I'm sure you all know the internet was invented by Bill Gates, right? In Palo Alto or Sunnyvale? There's some question about that. In his backyard, right? In the shed?
I have the answer for you. As soon as they start making money.
Ah, that's the answer. As soon as they start making money. Well, the internet was part of DARPA. DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency in the Pentagon. We, the people, funded that. We developed all of that technology. And then it gets handed over to the private sector. The same thing with avionics, almost in, that is to say, aviation, you know, handed over to United and American and the other airlines. In almost sector after sector, there is fundamental and crucial and critical government intervention. That means we the people, taxpayers, get to fund private corporations. So it's not really capitalism. Because when these banks or corporations fail, they don't go under, they get bailed out. So again, another key slogan of the Occupy movement was, you know, we got sold out, they got bailed out. And it's true. The people are constantly being sold out. And one of the elixirs that's kind of offered up is, of course, reform. Well, we hear your pleas, we hear your cries. The system is unfair. There seems to be some kind of wealth and income inequality in this country. Seems to be. I mean, it's off the charts. It's absolutely spectacular, the growth in these two indices. And I make a distinction between income and wealth inequality. And it's not made by economists, and it's certainly not made by the media. Income inequality is simply your salary. So if you make $200,000 a year, I make $300,000, you know, I get $100,000 more than you, one-third more than you. But it turns out that this gentleman over here has apartments in Paris and New York. He has a yacht. He has a private jet. He has memberships in all the elite golf clubs. He's a member of spas. He's invested in hedge funds. He's invested in all kinds of financial instruments. His wealth is much more than his income. So there's, I think it's, and that too has grown in a very, very sharp way. Now, how has this happened? It's happened because, well, one, you could say in a cynical way, we let it happen. But it's the political system. The Democrats and the Republicans have enabled this kind of corrupt capitalism to develop and to mushroom. And so they're in it to it, you know, up to their necks. So can you reform this kind of, you know, tiger? Can you change the spots of a leopard? It's very tempting to believe that we can change the spots of the leopard. But I contend that these are, you know, absolutely inherent and genetic problems, systemic and structural problems with the system, not with whether, you know, as we get all the time, Bernie Madoff, or who is the latest one, Matthew Mataram, right? You remember, you know what that's about? That's, you know, more corruption. Guess what? Insider trading on Wall Street. Never happened before. You know, people should go see Michael Douglas in Oliver Stone's Wall Street, that key scene where he turns to Bud, this young acolyte who wants to break into the market, you know, be a big trader like Gordon Gekko, who's played by Michael Douglas. And Douglas turns to him and said, "Hey, kid, everybody cheats. Everybody does it. You got to understand that. That's how the system works. And now, you know, you've seen The Wolf of Wall Street or American Hustle. But I think it's a fundamental mistake, actually, to focus on these bad apples. People like Bernie Madoff, people like Raj Rajaratnam, people like Ranjit Gupta, people like Matthew Matarum, and many others. And it goes back, you remember Ivan Boesky and Michael Milken and the junk bonds in the 80s, the Keating Five, then the Ken Lay and the Enron scandals. Always focus on the apples, never on the barrel that produces the apple. The barrel is insulated from scrutiny. That is the economic and political system. So let's get all virtuous, and people have gotten very virtuous, and denounce, you know, the vicious Bernie Madoff. You know, he stole money from grandmothers. He impoverished orphans. He did terrible things to people. Just like Congress? Yeah. And so that, I think, deflects from the systemic and structural problems that keep producing these kinds of bad apples. So I think we, you know, we really need to think about fundamental change in this country. Fundamental change. And that's going to be the key to saving the environment. And why we are doing this, you know, why are we destroying the bed that we sleep in? It's a very, again, it's not a rhetorical question. You know, we are destroying Mother Nature, and it's almost a kind of femicide, this ecocide, because nature has always been viewed historically, I mean, from early, you know, Christian texts, as something wild, untamed, and its energies must be harnessed. You know, it must be controlled. You know, so you have this very patriarchal and kind of macho vision of nature. And I'm reminded of what Chief Seattle supposedly said. Doesn't really matter if he said it or not. It's veracity, it's truth. He noticed among the European settlers, the white settlers, that there was a tremendous desire for materialism, for goods, for objects, and total disregard for their surroundings, for nature. And he said supposedly, if you keep soiling the bed you sleep in, you will ultimately choke on your own toxic fumes. That's what we're doing with this economic system. So it's again goes back to this issue of, you know, reform, like the economic crisis we were told, one of the many fairy tales, was that it was because Glass-Steagall was eliminated by Clinton in 1999. This enabled the distinction between commercial and non-commercial banks to be blurred. And supposedly, this encouraged banks to get into these exotic financial instruments, like subprime mortgages in particular. So what happens after, you know, the big crash? And by the way, I hope you're all enjoying the recovery. It started in 2009, in case you missed it. I missed it. I travel a lot, so I probably didn't see it. But apparently, it's, you know, it was announced in 2009 that we are on the road to recovery. And it's interesting, again, how the system is able to protect itself, draw the wagons around itself, and go through the panaceas and placebos of reform legislation. So Dodd-Frank, you know, named after, hey, Barney Frank, what's not to like, right? A great liberal congressman from this area. Chris Dodd from Connecticut. Wow, it's like all New England here. Only one missing is Tom Brady. Okay. Careful, okay. Almost from the get-go, the legislation was compromised. This shouldn't surprise anyone, as Richard Wolff points out in this book, Challenging Capitalism, that I have over here. The very people that are responsible for the problem are those that are crafting the legislation. And so now Dodd-Frank is completely full of holes. It's like Swiss cheese. It has no teeth. It has no enforcement power. It's totally useless. You know, you remember when Obama signed it, and there's, of course, the big front page photo of everyone and cheering on and clapping. I mean, it's like theater. You know, Bertolt Brecht would have gone to town on something like this, I think, in a very imaginative, you know, and creative way, maybe with a little music by Kurt Weill in the background. The Glass-Steagall Act in 1999, this is a piece of New Deal legislation that protected private banks from making risky investments, that the problems were much more systemic than the elimination of Glass-Steagall. I mean, there were deeper problems than that. And so Dodd-Frank is put up as, okay, we heard you, we're going to have this reform legislation. And this I'm reminded again of a debate that Howard Zinn had at Tufts in 1971 with William F. Buckley. I'm sure you were all there 40 years ago, where he, you know, really talked about the dangers of falling into these traps of reform, that where systemic problems need systemic overhaul, just cosmetic approaches are not going to help. So a little, you know, eye blusher here, lipstick there, talcum powder here is not going to resuscitate what is essentially a corpse. You know, we need new bodies. We need new ways of thinking. This is a time of, I think, that should be a spark for creativity and imagination. And, you know, the Occupy movement did show some of that. I mean, it was unable to sustain it because it was, you know, as a tactic, very difficult to keep in the long term. But while it was there, it was rocking the Kasbah to some extent. And, you know, I'd like to see what's coming up in terms of resistance. I don't know. But I know that there are a lot of people out there in communities. And again, if we had a national progressive media, you know, you would know what was going on in Taos, New Mexico. Or you would hear what was happening in Billings, Montana. You would know more about what was going on, that there are lots of things happening on the ground. Tens of thousands of co-ops have established themselves. I didn't mention another development that I learned about just today at Harvard Trade Union Program, that steel factories, steel workers in Pittsburgh are now cooperating with Mondragon, with this huge Spanish co-op, and learning from them and incorporating things that they feel are appropriate into their system of work and organization. So I think, you know, these things, you know, are really important. And again, I don't know why I'm quoting Howard Zinn so much, but maybe one of the reasons is because one of the last times I saw him was actually right around here as he was getting into a taxi. That was in November of 2009. He said, small acts, when multiplied by millions of people, can transform the world. I believe that's true. We've seen that over and over again, from lunch counters in North Carolina to buses in Montgomery, Alabama, to Adivasis in India that have rolled back enormous projects, multi-billion dollar projects. For example, a South Korean corporation known as POSCO was going to build a huge steel plant and a port in the eastern Indian state of Orissa. And there was blockades, there were strikes, there were boycotts, and they have been able to stop that particular project. Now, there are other projects going on, but these are some of the poorest people on the face of the earth. And they were able to organize themselves and defend the land, to defend Pachamama, to defend the earth against this kind of looting and plundering that I've referred to several times. Now, I want to end with some poetry, actually, and maybe this would give you some ideas. You know, I live in a town, Boulder, Colorado, which is the home of Naropa Institute. There's a Jack Kerouac School of Poetry that Allen Ginsberg and Ann Waldman started, and it's very distinguished. A lot of poets have come there. Amiri Baraka, who just passed away, was a frequent visitor, for example. Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Gary Snyder, and others. Well, in Boulder, if 75 or 80 people turn out for a poetry recital, people are very excited. They say, wow, this is a a real sign of cultural sophistication and, you know, aren't we lucky to live in this community? Well, I would just remind sometimes people of what goes on in South Asia, where I've been at poetry recitals where hundreds of thousands of people have turned out, sitting on the floor under a shamiana or on a sitting on a very rough kind of jute carpet and listening to poetry. It's a much bigger cultural experience than it is. And often many of these people are technically illiterate in terms of reading and writing, yet they are literate in terms of oral knowledge. They know poems, they can recite couplets, even rickshaw drivers in Lahore or in Delhi that I've met knew poetry, you know, from memory. Very impressive. And one of the greatest poets of South Asia is Faiz Ahmed Faiz, F-A-I-Z. It's curious, his first name and his last name is the same. He was born in Punjab in what is now Pakistan, Sialkot, in 1911, and he died in 1984. He's considered the greatest Urdu poet of this period. Urdu is an amalgam of Hindi and Persian and other Indian languages, a very, very expressive language. And this particular poem, Bol, which means speak, the imperative, speak, turns up in all kinds of ways in demonstrations, even in Nepal, even in Bangladesh, all over India and Pakistan. You see in demonstrations in the Hindi script or in the Urdu script, Bol, speak. So it's become a kind of anthem. Bol ke lab azad hai tere, bol zaban ab tak teri hai. Speak, your lips are free. Speak, your tongue is still yours. This magnificent body is still yours. But speak, your life is still yours. Speak, there is little time. But little though it is enough time. Enough before the body perishes, before the tongue atrophies. Speak, the truth still lives. Say what you have to say. Speak, your lips are free. Bol. So now you know a word in Hindi and Urdu. So the next time you go to Pakistan and India, which might be in the next couple of days, as far as I know, you'll be able to hear the word bol, speak, bol. This was one of Howard Zinn's favorite poems by Marge Piercy from her collection, The Moon is Always Female. It's called The Low Road. And it's really about, you know, solidarity, some of the things that I was trying to allude to earlier this evening. The Low Road. What can they do to you? Whatever they want. They can set you up, they can bust you, they can break your fingers, they can burn your brain with electricity, blur you with drugs till you can't walk, can't remember. They can do anything. You can't stop them from doing. How can you stop them? Alone, you can fight, you can refuse, you can take what revenge you can, but they'll just roll over you. But two people fighting back to back can cut through a mob. Two people can keep each other sane, can give support, conviction, love, massage, hope, sex. Three people are a delegation, a committee, a wedge. With four, you can play bridge and start an organization. With six, you can rent a whole house, eat pie for dinner with no seconds, and hold a fundraising party. A dozen make a demonstration. 100 fill a hall. It goes on one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again and they said no. It starts when you say we and know who you mean, and each day you mean one more. Marge Piercy. And this is Edward Said's, definitely from Marge Piercy, Edward Said's favorite poem. Edward Said's, you know, great scholar, activist, was really able to blend those two things. He passed away in 2003. And at his memorial at Riverside Church in New York, I learned that his favorite poem was the one I'm about to read to you by Konstantin Kavafi, called Waiting for the Barbarians. Kavafi was Greek-Egyptian. He died in the 1930s, I believe. And this speaks so much to the hysteria that has been generated since September 11th, that reappeared here in spades after the Boston Marathon bombing of April, where people were describing to me, I was in Watertown last night, it was a police state. I mean, the state security forces completely took over the entire area and kept people locked in their homes. And not just in Watertown. You know, I noticed this a couple of years ago in Denver at the Democratic National Convention in 2008, you know, our like Denver police. I mean, they had armored cars, and they looked more like SWAT teams or Navy SEALs than, you know, your local cop on the beat, you know, hi Joe, hi Bill, whatever. This isn't your local cop on the beat anymore. You've had a tremendous ramping up of not just surveillance, but the whole apparatus of state security. And they can get away with it because of fear, because of the propagation of fear, because of the manufacturing of enemies, of terror. They're everywhere. They're around us. We have to protect ourselves. So one is careful, you know, not to make too many comparisons. But, you know, there is a history of this kind of fear being manipulated and going in a very totalitarian direction. Waiting for the barbarians. What are we waiting for? Assembled in the forum. The barbarians are due here today. Why isn't anything happening in the Senate? Well, why do the senators sit there without legislating? Well, because the barbarians are coming today. What laws can the senators make now? Once the barbarians are here, they'll do all the legislating. Why did our emperor get up so early? And why is he sitting at the city's main gate wearing the crown? Because the barbarians are coming today, and the emperor is waiting to receive their leader. He's even prepared a scroll to give him, replete with titles and imposing names. Why have our two consuls come out today wearing their embroidered, their scarlet togas? Because the barbarians are coming today, and things like that dazzle the barbarians. Why don't our distinguished orators come forward as usual to make their speeches and say what they have to say? Because the barbarians are coming today, and they're bored by rhetoric and public speaking. Why this sudden restlessness, this confusion? How serious people's faces have become. Why are the streets and squares emptying so rapidly? Everyone going home, so lost in thought. Because night has fallen, and the barbarians have not come. And some who have just returned from the border say, there are no barbarians any longer. And now, what's going to happen to us without barbarians? They were those people, a kind of solution. Constantine Cavafy, 1864-1933. I said 1931. 1933, he passed away. I close with poetry, and I try and inject whatever art I can into a presentation, including skits about Dick Veneer and facade news, because I think art is really important in kind of leavening the bread. You know, we have our facts, we have our documentation, we have our evidence, but it's really important to have an artistic, you know, imagination, as Arundhati Roy of India likes to call it, to put in public spaces, like as Pete Seeger did, and let's remember him as well as Amiri Baraka, for decades and decades of enormous public service and wonderful music. You know, he's a very talented writer of music and composer and performer, and the Weavers and the Almanac Singers going back to the 30s. Art has a way of transcending day-to-day kind of banalities in a way that lots of facts do not. So I think, you know, whenever we can, you know, let's try and use poetry, use paintings, use dance, use theater to enlighten people, to extend the range of understanding and to be as creative as possible. So that's about all I have to say.
David Barsamian speaking at the Community Church of Boston. After a brief intermission, David took questions from the audience.